Welcome to Unlock Nashville. My name is Jennifer Relford. In this episode, we're going to give you the key to unlocking your home buying experience and where to look for help when you're ready to buy. Everybody knows me. I work with a lot of first-time homebuyers, and I have a lot of great friends who assist me in getting the job done. Our mission statement at Unlock Nashville is to connect buyers and sellers with lenders and vendors who can help them achieve their home buying goals. So today I'm here with one of my favorites. This is Mark Neely from the Neely Group. A little background about Mark and I. Mark was one of my first business associates. They helped me grow my brand, Unlock Nashville. I share a lot of his info. I know that you know his face if you guys follow every day. So of course, when I started my podcast, I wanted to have Mark on so that you guys can see how we interact together and how we could possibly help you achieve your dreams of home ownership. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I've always appreciated working with you. So tell us a little bit about yourself and how, you know, people, what you do, like, just let's talk.
Sure. So born and raised in Nashville. I grew up in the burbs. So I grew up on the north side of town, Gouldsville, Hendersonville area, but I've lived in Franklin for the last 25 or 30 years, I'd say. And got started, I guess when I bought my first home, I was already in the mortgage business. So I was like 27. So I bought a little condo in Florida. I got started in the mortgage business. And so ever since then, I've just been helping lots of people and growing real estate portfolio as well, buying and selling properties, and invested in some syndications that have done well. And so I really love, I think, just, you know, helping those people who maybe think they can't get a home, especially now more than ever. I think it's, you know, a lot of people feel like there's
hopeless, discouraged.
And
so you heard priced out lately.
They feel priced out, you know, the middle class being left behind, that kind of thing. And so it's just so important now to really know all of the details. And like, what is the best possible way to win? It's just not as easy as it once was even 2 years ago, you know, 3 years ago. So, you know, when rates do what they did, you really have to have sort of like a team around you to figure out, you know, just on the elevator up here, we were talking about, you know, 2-1 buy downs, you know, just little things like that. But also just knowing that there's grant programs that are available that maybe don't require an income restriction. There's just a lot of things I think that people need to be aware of. And so it's trying to leave no stone unturned as you're trying to search. So I, you know, work with a lot of first-time buyers, work with investors, work with people that are buying second homes in the beach area, you know, that sort of thing, or coming to Nashville. So I enjoy it all.
So you are licensed to do work in Florida.
Florida and a bunch of other states as well.
Awesome. So that's amazing. I have considered getting a Florida real estate license because a lot of people, especially here in the Nashville area, they do travel to the Panhandle and a little bit far, you know, deeper into towards Miami or Daytona. And they'll ask me all the time if I know anyone or could recommend anyone. So that has been top of mind for me here lately. But going back to, you said that you bought in your late 20s. Can you go back to maybe when you were a renter and what made you want to stay in that cycle, or what finally led you to want to be a homeowner?
Yeah. I mean, even now, even though like I had it a lot better than what, you know, people now, because, you know, the ratio of income to housing costs is much harder now for people. So I'm totally empathetic to that. I'm totally aware of that. But even now, if you can afford the payment, and it's not much difference than the rent, the average, you know, homeowner in America has a net worth of about $250,000, where the average renter is about $6,000. So that's really where the American family can start to build true wealth and use that wealth to do other things like improve the house that they're in, or buy a rental property, or even use money from the equity as the house grows in equity to maybe use for college tuition, and things like that. So I think for me, I grew up, you know, I'm a native Nashvilleian. My parents bought homes, you know, early in life. You know, they didn't go to college, but I watched my dad and my mom, who was a real estate agent, I watched them buy rental properties, like in the Madison area. Mm-hmm. And so just little properties and fix them up, rent them. And so I just was sort of, I knew the value of buying real estate mm-hmm. from an early age. And it just sort of stuck with me. And so I think once I realized that, you know, Franklin, that's where I was going to plant some roots, that, you know, this was a great little, I wish I, just like anyone, I wish I'd hung on to that little townhouse.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so amazing. So let's discuss, like, going back to when you said the difference in money from homeowning versus renting. If a renter only is worth about $6,000, explain to the viewers why that is and why someone that owns a home would have so much more money and the way that equity plays a part in that.
Right. Well, you know, there's a time and place to rent, a season in life to rent. And there's lots of reasons to rent. You know, I think that when you buy a home, though, you're buying an asset that appreciates over time. I mean, the record for real estate over the last, let's say, 81 years is like, you know, 73, you know, 3-1 or 73, 6-8-1 or something like that, whatever.
Right.
It's like ridiculous. Like, we've had like 3 or 4 down years.
Yeah.
It's just not very. So, I mean, imagine having a team where that's your record. I mean, you feel like pretty good about your chances. And so, you know, when you buy a home, it's appreciating. You have, you know, you're paying down the balance as you go. If you can buy a rental property, have someone else paying down the balance for you. And so that just compounds over time. It's very difficult to save money as fast as you normally build up equity when you own real estate.
It's
and
also hard to save money, Mark, when you owe bills. I mean, I think people sometimes are unrealistic. You know, if I'm paid $100 and I want to put $20 back, I've got to make sure all my bills are paid.
Mm-hmm.
Or else I need to use that $20, honestly.
Right, right.
And it's great to be paid $100 and break even, but you're never saving that way.
Right.
So I think that equity is like a back savings account for people. And in economic times, such as what we're having now, you know, you can pull out a HELOC, home equity line of mortgage or something,
mm-hmm.
borrow against that equity that's been in the background and help take care of all
for
your
sure.
bills. Do you agree with that concept?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if you can leverage, you know, some equity in your home to improve your life,
mm-hmm.
you always want to make sure that you're, you know, able to afford the payment and, you know, pay that back at some point or have a plan in place to do that. Maybe it's not to necessarily pay it back. Maybe you're going to move, you know, you're going to move in 5 years and the projection of the housing market and that property may go up to where when you sell it, you just pay off the HELOC, you know, so you're done with it at that point. But it's a great strategy. I mean, leverage is really, when used properly, it can be a very valuable tool. You know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of, you know, talk around the aspect of getting out of debt, and it, certainly that's a great aspiration, I think. But the sooner you can get into a home, I think the better off most people are going to be. I think a lot of people are just afraid of a crash. I think it's obvious now there's not going to be a crash, and the reason why is just because we have such a shortage of homes. Depending on who you read, I mean, we're somewhere 3 to 5 million homes short, so builders can't keep up fast enough. So we have this issue of normally you wouldn't have high rates and, you know, rising prices. Usually when rates go up, prices will go down. And I think people are just still shocked that, you know, what was a $350,000 home 2 years ago is now $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just thinking, well, that's not worth that. Well, unfortunately, the market says that it is. And so even though it's like, you know, a 10-year-old, 5-year-old, you know, a home that was built by, you know, a track builder that's, you know, it's not like it's some custom, you know, deluxe home. And so people are looking at it saying, this is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why is this, you know, priced this? Well, it's just the fact that, you know, the market stands. You've got so many people. I think people underestimate how many people are on the sidelines that have been waiting for rates to come down. And a lot of them are millennials. And so they're at the prime buying age, which is age 33.
Mm-hmm.
So historically, age 33 is the age which most millennials begin to buy homes. And so you have more millennials aging to age 33 right now than in the history of the United States.
Really?
And so that's huge. And you can even trace that back to the Roe v. Wade rule. If you go back 33 years after Roe v. Wade, there was a dip because abortion was allowed. And so you had a dip in at that age group. Mm-hmm. So now that's come back, you know, full steam just because of population growth. And now you have all these people that there's just more people than there are homes, more people that can buy, that will buy, will pay 7%, that will pay whatever, you know, there were houses closing, the closings happen every day, and people will pay 8%, like obviously in December, you know, it happens.
I've bridged a gap to make people understand. I like to make sure people understand that the first step of home ownership is not going to tour homes. The first step of home ownership is always going to be to see a lender or reach out to a realtor such as myself that can get you in with a lender like Mr. Neely that can run your financials and let you know just where you stand with the bank. Another thing is if the bank does tell you no, it's not a no, it's a not right now. And the majority of the lenders I work with on my panel are the type of people that will keep you in the know of what you need to do to get that pre-approval. They're not going to just write tell you no and send you packing. They want to help you. We all want to help you. So with that being said, help me help people understand that all they need is 20% down. And they don't even need 20% down all the time. It's not like when they're taking out these loans that they owe all that money right now. So if you just said that the homes go from 350 to 475, okay, your loan is good, amount will be larger, which means you'll need a little bit more, you know, because the math is going to be the math to get the down payment you need for whatever type of loan type, you know. So just help me bridge that gap with people, because I think they stay stuck in the number of this is what I owe, and it's not always just that cut and dry with the loans.
Well, I think that it's important to understand that, you know, there's kind of two schools of thought. I mean, we're here in you know, Dave Ramsey country. Mm-hmm. It's set, and so you have one side that would say save 20% down and do, you know, a 15-year fix. But if everyone did that, how many homes, how many people would be left out? You know, tens of millions of people would be left out, not ever taking advantage of buying a home. So the average down payment historically for first-time buyers is 6 to 7%.
Right.
So you can't convince me that it's not better for them to go ahead and get in for a smaller
loan,
smaller down payment. I mean, if you think about it, you're buying this asset, and compare that to buying, you know, Bank of America stock or some pick your favorite stock,
Apple, whatever.
Now instead of when you're doing that, you have to come up with $400,000 of money to buy that $400,000 of stock. With real estate, the bank actually lends you sometimes, you know, 97% of, you know, or maybe even more, maybe even 100% if you get a grant. So imagine not taking advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you look at it from that context and look at the fact that, hey, the house is going up in value at a faster rate than typically what your mortgage rate is. Mm-hmm. And if you can build some equity, then the idea, the average time people might stay in their homes 5 to 7 years.
Right.
Then they move to the next home and they were able to roll that equity into the new one for a larger down payment and move up as their needs change. So not to mention the fact that you get some tax advantages for the interest that's paid on the mortgage. So some of those advantages don't exist with renters. Again, there's gonna be costs involved. I mean, you have to mow the yard, there's things that go bad, you know, that break with a home that maybe when you're renting, you don't have that. So, you know, no one should ever stretch themselves, you know, to buy a home. It should be something that is, you know, in their plans that they can feel like they can afford the payment. It's not much difference from what they were paying in rent, or they have the prospect of maybe they're on a track at their job where they know that their income is going to increase. They're going to get, you know, an increase in their income because of the way the progression of their profession works.
Right.
And those types of things I think are important to understand, but you don't ever want to put yourself out. I mean, I have to tell people often, I mean, that look, even though you approved for something, that doesn't mean that this may not be right for you. You know, it's just, I'd rather someone know, you know, this, and I think it can get lost in the muddle, especially when someone's maybe self-employed or they've just never done it before. They're not sure exactly. And you can just kind of tell that this might be a strain, it's a big difference from what their other income or what their other payment was. And so it's better for people to be a little bit conservative, I think, you know, and know that this is something you're signing on, you know, for debt for a long period of time. You know, I think it's good to know. I think some people need to know right now foreclosure rates are really still at an all-time low. Mm-hmm. You know, inflation is up. Everything's costing more, anything from eggs, gas, and whatever else that's out there. So that's where I think people are feeling the pinch and the strain is just that just basic family living is more expensive right now. And so there's just not a lot of extra expendable income to go around.
Understood. So what's something that's gone wrong during your career and something you're glad to have experienced? Let's play the devil's advocate with that.
So, well, you know, we mentioned earlier, you know, no crash, no real estate crash on the horizon anytime soon because of the shortage. What you did have, though, back in 2005 was this huge run-up, and you had all these loans that were out there on the market. Have you ever seen the movie The Big Short? Steve Carell, I want to say Brad Pitt's in that. But it's all, it really tells the story of what happened. And I think I got caught up into that somewhat. And what I mean by that is, you know, I bought a property in Florida that was at the frothy, you know, we use this word frothy, it was a market, meaning it was a false sort of market. So properties values had run way up, and it was a false value in a sense, because they were all these values were predicated on these loans that were these risky loans that were highly, highly leveraged. And once they were adjustable rates with a huge prepayment penalty, that people were out there selling out on the market. And a lot of those loans, I would have to kick people out of my office. Like, I'm not selling someone a 228 with a 3-year prepay. It just means that, you know, 228 was fixed for 2 years. Then the rate went up.
Right.
And you had a 3-year prepay. So I was like, that's terrible for somebody. Why would you sell that? Why would you do that? So that's what happened. And so once they started getting behind on their payments, you know, they walk away because they're not really walking away from any equity, and it just tumbled like a house of cards. And so you had, and there was this one guy who figured that out, and this the character Steve Carell plays, but he predicted it because he saw all these derivatives. So you had all these investors, these stacks of investors hungry on Wall Street for these big returns. And once all those loans fell apart, it crashed. And so what I mean by crash, that housing went down like, you know, 25%. For a sustained period of time or more. And in the coastal areas, you had them, you know, in some of the higher areas like, you know, Phoenix, Miami, LA, you had places that were going down 40-50%. And that's very discouraging. And I think it took some time to bounce back from that. So I had a property that got caught up in that went way down in value. So in real estate, if you're an investor, you know, you're going to lose, you're going to take some losses. It's like anything. It's like investing in the stock market. So the idea is, you know, that you're doing it enough and you learn from your mistakes or learn from the decisions that you made, the choices, and you move, you know, going forward. You know, now I know that's a totally different situation. Those loans don't even exist. That whole industry went away. I mean, there's just those risky loans that were called subprime loans. They don't even exist anymore. And so it's important for people to know that now, because I think it's normal to want to speculate, well, gosh, isn't that going to happen again? And just the circumstances are just completely different. You had so many homes that were flooding the market, and there weren't enough buyers to sop that up, so prices just kept diving. Now it's flip-flops. You have
so many buyers.
Few homes, lots of buyers. And so that's the reason why prices have continued to go up, even with higher rates.
So speaking to the buyers versus sellers, you know that NAR has just completed their lawsuit and decided to settle. And so from the listing side, they'll no longer be paying the buyer's agents. They want those fees to be put onto buyers. And that's never been the way that real estate has worked. So let's talk about that a little bit and give me your opinion on that. And let's just kind of have some banter.
Well, I've read a lot of opinions about it, and I have agents that are, you know, top 50 agents here in Nashville that are personal friends of mine. And so I'll say this, the worst the more busy the agent, the less they're concerned about it. Okay. And what I'm hearing from them is, you know, there's not a lot changed in some regards. Now, I hear people saying that you're going to have a lot of pop-up, you know, flat fee, small fee for listings and all that sort of thing, or help a buyer. But all of those already exist.
Right.
And I think people need to realize those already exist. And so my understanding is from the people that I'll talk to that are involved and maybe brokers is that, yes, there may be some changes, but for the most part, they're still going to offer, you know, a buyer's agent, you know, a commission. So they, for their listing, if you want, they're going to, it's all in the value that you present. I think that, that agents who have a hard time, you know, presenting what their value proposition is to their client will have the harder time. So
right.
The more that you can present your value to your client, to your listing client, to your buyer, that's the better off you're going to be. And I think there's the whole other side, though, that say that you're going to have a lot of agents that are going to get out just because they, you know,
don't know how to negotiate.
We went through this in the lending industry where they changed the comp plan. It was Dodd-Frank. So, you know, it was these two senators that got involved all up in the lending, Chris Dodd and Barney Frank, and, you know, changed everything. And so, you know, in classic government fashion, you know, they were trying to do something good, and it was just overkill for a long time. And, but we pivoted, you know, we recalculated, you know, and we moved forward. You know, we figured out a way. It was, you know, remember, you know, TRID didn't exist. You just had what was called a HUD one settlement statement, you know, and now you have this 3 days before. I mean, you're getting before. So the 3 days before, I can see the spirit of that, right? Hey,
right.
You get somebody to see their settlement statement, what we're talking about here, you know, 3 days prior, where sometimes it'd be sailing in at the last minute.
You have to check for third
people are freaking out because, or stressed, I guess, is maybe the better way to say it, because, oh gosh, we're going to close and this final settlement statement is coming over, you know, at the closing time,
right,
or late or whatever, you know, for some lenders. And so, you know, that's where I think it really sort of tried to level the playing field for every lender to be able to do what we were doing already, which is, hey, you got to get it there early. And so people can review it and feel confident that they're doing, you know, their numbers match and their wire is right and all of that.
Right.
So, but man, I think this NAR thing is going to play. It's going to take 6 months for, I think, some dust to settle. I think it's right now. It's really important for everyone to sort of come together, support one another. I think the lending side, you know, for us to support you guys, figure out solutions to how we move through this. I think in the end, who's at risk, sadly, just like it was before, where mortgages became more costly after the whole Dodd-Frank thing, because there was more fees involved, and that was just part of what happened, and because of all of the extra stuff that had to be done. And so now it's the first time buyers, I think, that are at risk of being hurt from this, and I hate to see that, but I'm hopeful that there's a solution where, you know, Mr. and Ms. First Time Buyer are coming to buy a home, and, you know, I'm hoping that they don't have to feel like they have to come out of pocket with someone to represent them.
Right.
I would hope that, you know, but we're going to see how that all plays out. I mean, I think you're going to see some houses that are not going to offer, some listings are not going to offer that, but then they're going to me, I think they'll sit longer. I mean, you know,
right.
That's what I think. And so it remains to be seen, but that's my take on the agents that I talk to.
Right.
I mean, I don't know what Will says
and
or
for,
whatever.
Well, for the buyers that come through that, you know, that you've serviced, I know that they run the gamut, but you've got to remember the ones that barely make it through. So I don't want them in their savings to compensate to have representation.
Right.
That's just my only thing going forward. And then on the seller side, you know, it just makes me question, you know, how are you going to know who's coming to tour your home if they're unrepresented? I mean, it's
right.
just, are they going to allow them access to Realtrax to be able to find properties and
right.
make schedule show? It's just, like you said, it's going to take 6 months, and I guess it'll all play itself out, but it's just very strange. And I also, you know, from a tax standpoint, yes, I understand that the sellers want to keep their hard-earned equity and maybe not pay the buyer's agent, but on the backside of that, you know, it comes a point in time in negotiations where the numbers are just numbers.
Right.
And if we're going to walk away with you owing more for each agent and more for the close of the home, then let's just settle for what's going to make everybody comfortable.
Right, right.
You know, it's just, after a while, it just starts to be a nuisance with the numbers. So I just wanted your take on that. Then I was also going to ask you, how do you assess the risks and benefits of an investment since you do real estate investing a little bit? What would make you think a condo or a townhouse or a rehab even might, you know, get you the best bang for your buck or you know, maybe attract decent tenants that you won't have to chase around for rent, things like that? So what would make you interested?
Well, first of all, I think it's great to have good people around you. And so, you know, I always run things off of, you know, my core group of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, A, is the area, what's the area like?
Right.
Is it growing? Is it likely to continue to grow? I mean, what's really great is if you can get in front of development where development's coming to you, you know. And so we see that now as you go down, say, Dickerson Road,
mm-hmm.
For example, here in Nashville, as you travel north on Dickerson Road, now all of that's populating, you know, up with businesses and development. And so when you get into that, you know that the development's coming your way. And so you're in the way of development in a good sense. So anything like that's always good. And then just making sure that, you know, you're running your numbers to where, you know, you're assessing for vacancies,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, maintenance, those sorts of things where you're buying investment property. Those are always what you want to do.
So what types of things do you kind of look for when you're assessing? I like for cleaned up gas stations. So when you say the Dickerson Road area, you can tell that it's a little bit more, you know, getting to be a little bit more posh than when I moved here for college. So that's what lets me know that the area is getting revitalized and that there's good stuff going on.
Yeah. So your question is just like, what do I look for in terms of like the areas? Mm-hmm. I mean,
you like parks?
Sure. If you're close to the parks, what are the schools like?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is the, you know, the area look like in terms of is it the type of age group you want to be around? I mean, like if you're a young family, are you moving into an area that's, you know, it's mostly, you know, retirees? Maybe
mm-hmm.
you know, kids want to have anybody to play with. So,
right.
But I think having parks, we got a lot of great parks here in Nashville.
Walkability.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've got, you know, good grocery stores, you know, restaurants, things that you're going to want to frequent, convenience stores, that sort of thing. You know, what's interesting as we move through this, very few of these like drugstores, CVS's, there seems to be less and less of them. So
yeah,
Walgreens
is
the world.
Walgreens is a little bit more popular than CVS nowadays.
So,
I noticed that recently.
So, but in general, both of them, just because you can get so many things online,
mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, nowadays, you know, it's just packages come to your front door. So, but man, there's a lot of great places, I think, in just the Middle Tennessee in general, that still have a ways to go. And I mean, people just continue to come here. And I think just because, I mean, you've been here over two decades,
yeah.
I grew up here. And to me, you know, it's just now getting good. There's still, I mean, you have the surrounding counties that all touch Davidson County that are all great places to live. Whether you're on the north, south, east, or west.
Easy access.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not far to come into town to go to dinner or, you know, if you want to go to a show,
mm-hmm.
go to a Preds game, Titans game, you know, whatever it may be, you know.
Yes, so you started the Neely Lending Group.
Neely Lending Group.
August 2023, how's that going for you?
This is going great.
Okay.
So I'm a broker. I'm a broker part of the platform. Go Rascal is the company.
Okay.
So I have my own group, that small boutique shop team that work with me. And so we serve all kinds of clients, like I said, anywhere from first time buyers to investors, and do commercial loans as well.
Mm-hmm.
Fix and flip. Do ground up construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think just being able to diversify, was really a big thing for me, and this ability to be able to build a team. And I think on the broker channel, what I like is that just have a little bit more control over pricing for clients. You know, we're able to shop the entire market and be able to present them with options that maybe they didn't have before when they're just going to, you know, Bank X or whatever.
Right. So. Awesome. That's super cool. Well, I love your content creation. So talk to me a little bit about that. Were you ever shy? Did it come naturally for you?
No, it did not come naturally. No. If you go back, my oldest videos still exist there on Instagram. And it's just, you know, it's like anything you do in life, you know, you're going to suck at it at first. And you just suck a little bit less as you do. You keep doing it to where you eventually, you know, get okay at it. And then if you keep doing it, then maybe you kind of get decently good at it. And so, but if you don't start, you're never going to. You're never going to get started.
Right.
And so I think just learning from other people, and now I help other people sort of, you know,
get
over the nervousness, help them build their brand. You know, so I help realtors, other loan officers do the same thing.
So cool.
You know, so it's fun. I think the idea is, you know, to build your brand, no one can really take that away from you. It's kind of like your education, but now you've got all this content that lives out there that, you know, that people can be educated on, and they can reach out to you through DMs. And the whole idea is, you know, DMs lead to conversations, which lead to closings. So
are you more of a numbers guy, or are you more of a factual guy? Like for myself with this podcast, I would like to do for each episode a real estate term, mm-hmm. and break it down, because we all speak in a lot of,
right.
you know,
lingo.
A lot of lingo, and people can't always keep up. So I have to catch myself when I say HELOC.
Right.
OSTR.
Right.
You know, I have to make sure that people understand what those acronyms mean. So what's your favorite things to discuss on your social media accounts?
Well, I think, you know, one of the biggest things I think is just, you know, I've had a few videos have gone, you know, viral, multi-billion, mm-hmm. stuff like that. I think, you know, what seems to be, you know, a topic that people like to discuss is this idea that we talked about earlier about putting 20% down. I think just some people just think some people still think you have to. Like they come
into. I think
into
it's a number that's been thrown around for so long, Mr. Mark. I just think that we can't, even sometimes when I speak, I have to watch myself because there is FHA mm-hmm. that is a 3.5, mm-hmm. you know. So I think it's just a bad habit of people to say that you need 20%
yeah.
down.
You'd just be surprised
yeah.
the people that I talk to that would be surprised, and they would say, well, I thought you had to put 20% down. No. So, you know, I think just educating people along those lines, also just knowing that there's things that exist out there to help you with, like, you know, house hacking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the coolest things you can do is buy a multi-property house, you know, like a duplex or a triplex, and rent out the other side. And you know, help pay your mortgage, and you know, rebuild an equity. So now, you know, or house hack in the sense that as you buy a home that's maybe not your forever home, knowing that going in, that you have this plan to stay in it for at least a year, and then maybe do a little sweat equity in it, just meaning do some improvements to the home, you know, paint and some aesthetics to it, and then you get ready, and then you sell that home. So, you know, I think I'm a big believer in never selling your first home, you know, because now you can continue to, you know, just build your portfolio, because after a year you can move out of it, you know, and buy another property mm-hmm. with a lower down payment.
Right.
And you can, you know, now rent that property out. Now you become, you know,
you're
real estate.
You become
a real estate investor.
So explain how, if that's also a form of house hacking. So if mm-hmm. instead of selling your first home, mm-hmm. you would what, pull money out in a HELOC?
If you need to, you may not
credit.
Need to. If you saved up
right.
5% over that first year, or 5% down is what you'll need on your second time you're buying a home. You can't really use a 3% down loan anymore. You can use an FHA loan the next time, but
right.
you can't have two FHA loans in most circumstances. But probably the best way to do it is, you know, if you have very little down, is to do a 3% down conventional loan, first time buyer loan. It's going to be less expensive than FHA just because of the PMI. There's more costs involved with FHA. Now, having said that, if you have a lower credit score, FHA becomes what I mean by lower is, say 680 or lower, mm-hmm. FHA actually becomes better than conventional. Right. But if you have 700 or above, conventional, 3% down, live it in a year, move out, maybe save up 5% down for the next home, put 5% down, get the seller to ask, try to negotiate the seller to pay the closing costs, and now you've bought another home, and you rent out the other one to cover your payment.
Right.
And I think it's important for people to understand that you don't necessarily need to cover, it's not so much the cash flow being the greatest, you know, factor. You know, you may cash flow a couple hundred dollars, but and people may say, well, gosh, that's a lot. What if the water heater goes out? You definitely want to have some reserves so that you can cover some maintenance on the other house. But what you have to realize is that it's not just the cash flow. That's just one aspect. You have the appreciation of the home,
right?
And then you have the loan pay down, and then you have the tax advantage. And so if you can do that, you've got four advantages going for you, you know, with now converting that property to a rental property.
Awesome. So finances will always come into play from beginning to end in a real estate transaction. How do you help your clients plan so they don't have buyer's remorse? If they're coming straight out of the rent trap into home ownership, like you're saying, if the faucet leaks or whatever, they're used to having a property manager or whatever, you know, a concierge in a condo or whoever that comes and takes care of those things. But as a homeowner, they'd be responsible. So how do you kind of...
Well, first of all, a great realtor will always recommend a home inspection. Mm-hmm. So I always recommend that. It's usually the realtor that will recommend the home inspector. Mm-hmm. These home inspectors have a job, and they have a vested interest, to tell the truth about the house, mm-hmm. and give them this, you know, usually 18 or 20 page report, because their name's on the line. If something were to come back that they mm-hmm. missed, mm-hmm. it can become a huge mess, and all of a sudden they're liable, could get sued. Mm-hmm. So home inspector is a really good, that's one way to protect himself with a home inspection. And then I think having some reserves, I just don't like to see people move into a house and you've got $1,000 left over. Mm-hmm. It's too tight. And, you know, I think making sure that the property, is in good sound condition, even outside of, like the home inspection. So.
Right.
Making sure that you think you're gonna like living there. You may meet your neighbors. I've seen people move into a home and then the home next door was a short-term rental, SDR. And so all of a sudden now it's loud, mm-hmm. They're
traffic
partying or whatever, and maybe they've got a small family. So maybe not the best fit for them. So it's just, there's a lot of things to check. And I think a great realtor is gonna help them look at the whole lay of the land. And then on the financing side, you just want to make sure that you're comfortable with the payment. With a fixed rate mortgage, the payment shouldn't go up unless property taxes go up or your homeowner's insurance goes up. And so otherwise, it shouldn't go up.
Awesome. So what are some pros and cons of renting versus owning?
Well, pros and cons of renting, you don't have the maintenance costs.
Right.
You're not, if something breaks, or if it needs a new roof, you're not
mm-hmm.
putting on a new roof. Now, the roof thing, though, a lot of times in Tennessee, because we get hail, a lot of times it can be filed on your homeowner's policy because, they'll get up there and they'll show hail damage, and now all of a sudden it's issue. Because a roof can be expensive.
Right, yeah.
It could be
HVAC.
Yeah, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 for a roof, depending on how big the house is. HVAC. $3,000, $5,000, $7,000, something, mm-hmm. depending on what the size mm-hmm. of the HVAC is. But those water heaters, so those things, if they go out, you want to make sure that you have some reserves. And that's another thing, the reason why the home inspection is going to get into the nuts and bolts of that. How old is the roof? How old is the HVAC? How old is the water heater? Is it worked? Are they working properly?
Right.
Because if it's on its last legs, you may try to negotiate, for that to be paid for an upgrade.
Home warranty, just to make sure that you've got extra. I like to sell a lot of new construction, especially the first time home buyers, because they're coming out or whatever, and mm-hmm. I can normally get them all new appliances. But with that being said, like we were talking about, making sure that the home is ready and things are going to be okay with the inspection, you'll need to run the VIN numbers because you don't know mm-hmm. who where you bought them from or where they're from or
right.
who built them. So I would hate for your fridge to go out a month
right.
later. So we run the VIN numbers and ensure that there's no, you know, manufacturer's defects or anything like that. So per usual, finances are a sensitive topic and they come up in all realms. But when they're applying for a loan with you or considering buying a home, what's important for you to know? And we'll wrap it up with
yeah, that. Yeah. So great question. And just to tag off that other, I mean, you know, the pros of on the home was what we mentioned earlier.
Right.
Just, you know, you've got this asset that's appreciating value that you didn't have to save up 100% to buy that asset. And so then you get these tax advantages and then, you know, you could possibly move out of it at some point and have someone rent it out and pay the payment for you. So there's definitely, you want to weigh out, you know, are you going to be in the area? You know, if you're planning, if you may move in a year or two, you know, who's to say the market's flat or,
right.
you know, in your particular day. Your real estate's hyper-local, meaning it depends on the neighborhood. I mean, you may have a neighborhood that goes down 1%,
mm-hmm.
across town that went up 10%.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends on the neighborhood. So you want to look at what's going on, you know, in that neighborhood. If you think, well, you're in a job that could possibly be transferred in 2 years
mm-hmm.
or a year, something like that, before you pull the trigger to buy a house. So what we look for, you know, it's important that the top two or three things are going to be, you know, how's your credit? What do you, most people generally know about what their credit scores are before we get into that. And if there's problems there, then we talk about what's causing that. And so we look for solutions to see if we can help get them up. I've got a really great friend who owns a credit repair company who, you know, for a small fee, he gets them in, he gets deletions taken off. So he gets things taken off their credit. Think of like a speeding ticket. You know, not to, we know intellectually not to pay the speeding ticket.
Right.
Because what happens, well, it just goes on your record. You
right.
know, you go to the driving school because they can expunge it. But what you want from a credit standpoint, you want that same thing to happen. You want to have it expunged, removed completely from your
mm-hmm.
from your credit. So
right.
getting a deletion is a big thing, and you have, there's a way to go about that that's will get it done. You don't want to just pay it without negotiating that deletion in writing.
Okay.
So the credit, their income, you know, knowing that their if their taxes are up to date, if,
mm-hmm.
if they if they're self-employed particularly, because sometimes people, you know, may have be delinquent on their taxes.
Right.
Maybe they haven't filed yet. Maybe they owe back taxes.
Right.
Those are the types of things you want to know. Are they planning on leaving their job in the next 30 days or something
no.
like that? You don't want to, like, you know, quit their job because you'll get your loan and get denied. You
right.
gotta, you know, there has to be a prospect, a likelihood of you continuing to be working there. And the lender's going to check that. You know, they're going to check with your employer and make sure you still work there.
The
you haven't turned in, yeah, you haven't turned in your notice. And so, and then what their funds are to close, you know, there doesn't need to be a lot of cash deposits going in. So if you have a job where, you know, you're getting a lot of cash, you want to be able to document that. That's going in, because underwriters will look at your bank account to see this big influx of money. Now, some people say, you know, a question for somebody that's a new home buyer every now and then, they'll say, well, what does it matter as long as my money's in there? Why can't my parents just give it to me? Well, they actually can. You can get a gift from a family member, but you just have to document that the right way. You know, you have to show that it came from the family member. And so there's a way to do that that's easy, and there's a way to do that that's difficult. You just want to put yourself in a position where you've complicated things, and one way to do that is having a bunch of cash deposits going into your account. So you want to try to avoid that. But those are probably top two or three that we look at.
Okay.
You know, they're likely, obviously their debt to income ratio, what's going on. You know, there's an easy way to figure that. There's loan calculators. You kind of look at what your gross pay is. I mean, lenders use gross pay, not the net pay. Some people, That's a hot topic. And why do they use the gross when what we get is the net? It's
right.
a great point. And really the reason for that is because people have different deductions.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas you might have two people at work at, say, St. Thomas Hospital, and this person may, you know, take the insurance and the 401k, and this person
mm-hmm.
may not.
Gotcha.
So you don't. So the only way to kind of keep it, you know, level, they just figured out is to use the gross.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what lenders do.
Okay.
But you always want to look at what is your actual net and what
right.
are you comfortable with. Just because a lender says, hey, you're qualified for this, if that payment is just causing you, like, you know, to take a step back, like, man, I'm not sure, there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe look at a lesser expensive home, or look at a different way to maybe get your rate down. Can you negotiate a buy down where you can buy the rate down a little bit, and then get the payment lower where it's more affordable?